Today at Reader's Corner, Lydia Millett, the author of the National Book Award finalist, The Children's Bible. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. On today's program, novelist Lydia Millett talks with us about her latest novel, A Children's Bible. The book follows a group of 12 eerily mature children on a forced vacation with their families at a sprawling lakeside mansion. Contemptuous of their parents, the children decide to run away when a destructive storm descends on the summer estate, embarking on a dangerous foray into the apocalyptic chaos outside. Lydia Millett is the author of more than a dozen novels and story collections. She's received awards from Penn Center USA and the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Her books have been finalists for the Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, the National Book Critics Circle Award. She joins us today from her home outside Tucson, Arizona. Lydia Millett, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, it probably makes some sense that someone who's affiliated with the Center for Biological Diversity in Tucson would write a climate change novel. I wonder if you could share with us, before we get into the book, the work of the center and just what you're doing that makes a difference.
Well, we have been working sort of on the extinction crisis for many, many years, well, since our inception in the late 1980s. I joined in 99, so I've been there a while, but we do a lot of litigation under the Endangered Species Act to mostly to make the government do its job and protect animals and plants from going extinct. And then we became involved in climate work more recently, although still not very recently. I feel old talking about it, but you know, probably about 15 years ago when one of our lawyers wrote the petition that got polar bears protected under the Endangered Species Act. So we do both of those things, extinction, climate, and also now increasingly environmental justice and equity and environmental and public health as well.
You know, it's interesting in reading your book, I thought more than once about how, especially someone with your background, could have written about what you're concerned about in this book in the form of nonfiction. You could have written 200 or 300 pages on the work of the center and biodiversity. You chose the novel, and it reminded me of a recent biography I happen to be reading right now called The Good American, the epic life of Bob Gersony, the U.S. government's greatest humanitarian. And at the beginning of the bio, the author, Robert Kaplan, is describing Gersony's library. And he says, it's rich with literature from the various countries he served. And he says, quote, it's often in the guise of fiction that authors can more easily tell the truth. And boy, reading the children's Bible, you figured out a way to tell the truth through the eyes and the voices of children that is way more effective than just reading 300 pages of a treatise on biodiversity, if you will. So let's start right there and begin with the upcoming storm and the parents who rented this place. Tell us about who they are and why they may typify how we got where we are today.
Well, you know, I wanted to write about the anger of young people and also have some humor. And so I sort of found the humor of the book in the parents, sort of my generation. Basically, the setting is this sort of robber baron mansion in the country where the parents have taken their large group of children and teenagers who've never met each other before for a very long summer vacation. The parents are old college friends. And right away, they take away the kids' devices, so they don't have any connection to the digital world anymore. And they are really at loose ends, and they really resent their parents. And so they start playing this game where the whole point of the game is to disassociate yourself from your particular parents, to not be identified with a given set of parents by the other kids. And so they're playing this game and being disgusted by their parents' behavior because the adults are sort of decadent and heavy drinkers and not particularly attuned to their children. And so the kids are playing this game and busily being repulsed by their parents when a great storm descends on the countryside, and chaos sort of erupts in the wake of that storm. So that's the setting. And yeah, I was sort of writing, I think, about these people who are privileged, but not extravagantly privileged. That is, they're sort of in the top, I don't know, 5%, but not the top, you know, 1%. I don't know. They're sort of arty, and some of them are professors. They're not titans of industry or anything like that. But I was writing about the parents clearly as a proxy for my own generation, because I'm about the age of the parents in the book. And the children are about the age of my own children, who are 13 and 17 right now. So it's a sort of, has allegorical aspects, but also I think, you know, has enough sort of a comic slant to keep me entertained while I was writing it, which is, you know, it's always one of my goals to make myself laugh as I write. Because I figure if I don't at least make myself laugh, I'm certainly not going to make anyone else even
well,
smile.
I hope to point out a few of those cases, because that there were some hysterical moments in this book. And I had to be careful, because I have to admit, I read for plot mainly. I'm not an English major. And so I had these 3 degrees in political science, and I just love the plot. This is the perfect book to read a second time for a guy like me, because in the second reading, I was really able to zero in on some of the incredible things you had to say. But let me pick up on something regarding the anger of the kids. I grew up in the Cold War, and I still have memories of the nuns throwing me underneath my desk to save me from the nuclear bomb in these drills we used to have. And I've run into a number of people my age who could remember the very same thing. But what I also remember is the foreboding that would come from that, where you'd walk home and you'd wonder about the end of the world, and you'd wonder about your parents and where they would be and what have you. And as I'm reading your book for the first time, it occurs to me that the climate change talk, which is very important, of course, but the climate change talk probably affects these young people similarly to the way I was affected with this, you know, scare of the big bomb.
I
wonder if you could comment on you. I think at some point you even mentioned in one of the reviews to a reviewer that you got some of this from your kids, who are like, why isn't somebody doing something about this?
Right. I mean, I do. I remember something like what you remember. That is, we weren't doing drills by the time I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, at least not where I lived. We weren't doing the kind of drills that you described from, you know, the 60s and 50s, although, you know, my mother did those drills and my father did those drills. But I remember the first protest I ever went to, and I didn't go to a lot. I wasn't really that kind of kid. But the first one I did go to in high school was about cruise missiles. So it was about the Cold War. And this was in Canada, and it was a protest against American cruise missiles being placed on Canadian soil, actually, is what it was. But I very much felt that I was living under this sort of Damocles of the nuclear threat. And, you know, 80s was still full on Cold War. And I do think that the climate threat and the extinction threat feel like a sort of Damocles to the young, as they do to me also. But this sort of sense of oppressive doom, you know, that you don't have the personal power to escape on your own, this descending cloud, I think, is one that very much my children and their generation live with. And and also, you know, a sense of outrage that the people who are supposed to be protecting them could have put them in this situation through their mismanagement of the political world and the cultural world. And so my experience of my own kids aren't particularly rageful or particularly activist, although they do have strong opinions. But they are very thoughtful, and a lot of their friends are more overtly activist. I think when you grow up with two parents who are activists, you might be, unless they force you to follow their pursuits, you might be a little slower to come to that yourself. But for whatever Right. reason, they're thoughtful, but not typically by choice on the streets, waving signs or anything like that. But I do see just a lot of engagement from people their age and in their 20s, a lot of rage that I consider to be righteous and long overdue, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to write about that, that anger and its sort of pure quality, because there's so much destructive anger around us now too in culture, but that kind of anger over climate and the extinction of other animals and plants, that kind of anger I can really get behind. And so that's what I was sort of doing in this novel.
You're here at Reader's Corner, and we're talking to Lydia Millett, who's the author of the National Book Award finalist novel, A Children's Bible. You know, the protagonist of your novel is Evie, and obviously she seems to be some kind of a composite. Well, maybe I should ask you, is she a composite of the kind of people you're talking about here? I thought when I read Evie, the more I read her, I kept thinking of Greta Thunberg and Amanda Gorman, who gave the stunning poem at the inaugural this year. Your thoughts?
Well, actually, I mean, that's a great interpretation. I wrote the book before I really had even heard of Greta Thunberg, but for sure, you know, I think she's great. I think she's really just lovely and inspiring. And there are others like her, though she clearly is the most prominent of the youth activists. But no, I think she's great, and she could easily be a piece of Evie. It's just that, you know, that wasn't the chronology. But I think it works perfectly.
I was really fascinated at the moment the young people finally gave up on the parents, and you have this. Beautiful section where you, and I'll just read it quickly. Nevertheless, your fitness to maintain order has been undermined. So from now until the day when your collective is restored to its baseline competency level, we'd like to take on more responsibility. And then they go on to talk about how they've drawn up a plan. You know, I'm not the first person that said, this sounds something like Lord of the Flies. How do you react to that?
Well, it's different from, although I cannot summarize the plot of Lord of the Flies for you anymore. It's been, I literally read it in high school.
But, same here.
My memory is that that really there's a lot of, the difference between this and Lord of the Flies is that the children don't sort of turn on each other, don't become these sort of ravaging and desperate creatures or, you know, murderous, quite sort of the opposite, right? They actually take on the roles that their parents should have played in the first place. And they become the parents of their own parents. You know, these children take on the duty that should have been, that shouldn't really have been theirs to start out with. The duty of care that their parents didn't honor. So actually it has, you know, I guess I'd say more of a happy ending in my memory than Lord of the Flies.
Yeah,
but in some ways, it's a group of children, right? So who are sort of in this marooned situation. So in that way, I think there's a comparison, I guess.
Yeah, and I think given the fact that it is an allegory, I can see this book being used for years in the classroom, the way Lord of the Flies was used. There's so many interesting things teachers can do with this, whether it's a biology class or whether it's a class in sociology.
Oh, I like that idea. I think that you're doing my job for me here of promoting my book. That's fantastic. Yeah. It should be in the canon, of course.
There you go. So let's talk about Jack, Evie's little 9-year-old brother. That really brings us to the title of your book, A Children's Bible. Tell us what he runs across and how that has something to do with the plot here.
Well, Jack has been brought up in such a secular setting in Brooklyn that he actually, as they're driving past a church in Evie's memory, leaving the city, he actually looks up and asks his parents what the long plus sign on the top of the building means. So he's had this you know, non-religious upbringing so far. He's a little guy. He's I think he's the age my son was when I was first writing the book. So he's, you know, he's around 10, maybe 9. I can't even remember now, maybe 11. Anyway, he's a little guy and sort of in some way acts older than his age, as Evie does, but in some ways not. And he's given this picture Bible, this story Bible by one of the parents. And he's a voracious reader and he has many, many picture books he loves. And this becomes one of them, and he kind of carries it around and tries to interpret it in the terms that he understands, which are the terms of nature and science. And so he loves the Bible. He has no sort of, you know, wariness of it, because he doesn't come with any baggage really about it. And so he's able to sort of love it in his own terms, and interpret it in his own terms. And as he does so, there are certain things that happen in the book that also are parallel to some of the sort of greatest hits of the Old and New Testament, the stories that I always saw in, you know, in children's Bibles, Bible stories, picture Bibles when I was growing up. You know, Noah's Ark, of course, is the first, but other things too, Cain and Abel, and then the stuff from the New Testament that even those of us raised outside Christianity can readily recognize. You know, and in the story, there's sort of a burning bush, there's a Sermon on the Mount. There are a lot of these little parallels, but for Jack, what's important, because he's a very sweet, gentle child, what's important are sort of his visions of God and Jesus and the Holy Ghost as forming a part of the scientific worldview that he knows and aligning with those parts of the world. And you know, this is something I've been interested in for a long time, the sort of needless schism, I think, in our country between science and certain forms of religion, a sort of, I think, destructive and nonsensical notion that religion and science have to be in conflict with each other. And I've written about this in several books now, including one called Sweet Lamb of Heaven that came a couple books before this one. But it seems to me that, you know, it's, you know, faith and science and reason really can be compatible, and it kind of breaks my heart the way that that we've fabricated a conflict between them in American culture. So I'm sort of playing with this too when I describe Jack's embrace of his child's Bible.
And Jack is a miniature Noah of sorts. Noah was trying to save the animals from the great flood, and Jack's trying to save certain animals from extinction as a result of this storm. Could you just share with us how he decides to handle bees? I mean,
so there are beehives in the one of the fields near this big house they've rented, and when the rain starts, he gets very worried about the bees. And so he and his best friend among the children, named Shell, unfortunately carry one of the hives indoors and put it in a closet in the basement, where he then unfortunately shuts the door and then realizes the bees have emerged from the hive inside that room. Anyway, so because he's very worried they're going to be hurt by all the moisture.
Right, right. Well, I just love the way you did that. And I'm glad you mentioned the long plus sign. I have to admit, I Googled the long plus sign, wondering if somewhere in my past I missed this great description. And I didn't find it. So obviously, congratulations on inventing the long plus sign if you did that.
Well, that was actually stolen from my own son. So yeah,
that's very clever.
He was much younger than Jack was, yeah, in the book when he yeah, said that.
It's also interesting in that section of the book where Jack's explaining Adam and Eve and the snake that tempted them, and at the end, I forget who's asking him, said, "Well, what did you get out of this?" And he said, if you have a nice garden, never leave it. Boy, that really sums it up. Sums it up in a much different way than I'm sure you're going to hear from men and women of the cloth, but nonetheless. So,
well, sometimes simple formulations are the best, don't you think?
Absolutely, absolutely. Let's talk about the redneck soldiers. There's some bad guys that land in the middle of your novel and do some damage. I'll just leave it at that. We are always careful at Reader's Corner not to ruin the plot. So we want to make sure everybody gets to read this and come out to the at the ending the same way I did. But I think you could share with us anyway, where'd this idea come from? I mean, I have to admit, and I know you wrote the book before the insurrection at the Capitol in January, but the minute I started reading these guys, the first thing I thought of was insurrectionists and those who came before them who acted like those at the Capitol that day. But I want you to tell us how this works.
That's actually exactly right. And it's funny, you're the first person who's mentioned that to me, that particular, you know, the January 6th thing and the correspondence there. I mean, I live out in the desert, you know, and certainly over the past 4 years, I've really noticed that sort of angry subculture of white men more than I had before. I love living in Arizona, even though I lived in New York before this, and I'd always sort of been in big cities, but I love this place, but I am, you know, frequently sort of alienated by a certain presence of sort of anger and hatred in some of the folks I see, even just at the gas station or the neighborhood bar here. And like, for example, I just put on Instagram yesterday, it's not a bumper sticker, it's like a rear window decal that I ran into at the vehicle emissions testing center near here that I pulled my car into yesterday. So a guy has a sticker in the back of his really large jacked up truck that just says, "Kill everything." And it wasn't a joke, you know, didn't right. appear to be a joke. So there is that in American culture, that strand, that sort of, that very, I don't know, sort of violent, threatening strand. And these guys are a thread in that strand, the sort of entitlement and the rage and the sense of aggrieved victimhood that, you know, of course has many sources, but which we've seen be so visible over the past 4 years.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Lydia Millett, the author of the novel A Children's Bible, nominated for the National Book Award. The novel has been called a masterly allegory for the climate crisis. I don't know whether I'll have time to get to all of them, but there's these moments where one of your characters in the novel comes out with something that is so interesting. And in this case, since I spent many years at the university, I had to laugh and think, I wish I could have figured out a way to say this without getting a vote of no confidence by the faculty or something. But I think it's Evie who's talking about her mother and describing what her mother did. And she says, "My mother's habitat had been the university. Her articles full of long words and the names of other scholars. Articles 5 people read." We always used to say articles that collect a lot of dust, but no matter how you say it, you said it beautifully. Why the jab at the university? Which I think is very well done.
Yeah, I mean, so I also grew up in you know, my father was actually an Egyptologist, so he was a professor his whole adult life and also a curator of the Egyptian department at his museum in Canada. And so I very much was surrounded by academics as a kid. And I still am now, because that's what most of my best friends do. And I love, there's so many things I love about academia, and I've read such beautiful writing emerge from academia. And I don't even mean fiction. I mean, you know, critical writing that's very beautiful. But also I do feel there's this sort of hyper-referentiality that happens where something that might have universal interest is created through the idiom of the academy as something, you know, sort of that contains these self-limiting kind of parameters that sort of prescribes its own irrelevance sort of in a particular way. And yeah, so that was a bit of, but I also think it has real effects in culture that we, you know, our in particular anti-education bias in this country is really hurting us profoundly. I would say more and more as time goes on. And I think that the academy should play a role in addressing that, you know, itself, should be more oriented toward outreach beyond itself, you know, and should even busy itself with creating materials that don't merely speak to its own community. And that does happen sometimes, of course. I mean, it happens, you know, I've seen really great examples of it, but I also, when it comes to writing and language and the literature of academia, I wish I saw more that the average person could read more readily, and especially in the arts.
Well, I know there's a number of comic moments in this book that I've referred to already, but there is one more that I'd like you to comment on. You have a line in here. I think it's when there's a description of the parents, and there's some yacht parents who own a yacht. And the quote is, "Those yacht parents are the worst. Those are the people that ate the planet." And you can comment if you care on that, but I definitely want you to share with us, if you could, how one of the kids named David gets back or seeks his revenge on the yacht parents. And you have to read, I read this the first time and I didn't even pay too much attention to that. Wait a minute, this kid's going to have this boat. Anyway, you tell the story, Lydia.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a brief scene, but he's sort of a tech monkey wrencher, you know, he's a bit of a hacker. And so he involves himself in the operation of their yacht before he leaves it. And, you know, in a technical way, he decides against doing something that would end up, you know, a form of sabotage that would end up, you know, spewing fuel into the ocean or whatever. And chooses something a little more subtle, but we encounter the yacht folks again later and see what's happened to them.
Yes, indeed, indeed. Well, this has been great. I can't recommend this book more highly. It's A Children's Bible by Lydia Millett, and I'm looking at my copy of it right on the front cover. It says National Book Award finalist. Congratulations on that again.
Thank you.
I think you've done a marvelous job here in really having us stop and think a little bit about where the future is going and listening more to our kids. How's that for a closing?
That's great.
Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Robert.
Take care.
All right.
Bye now.
Bye. Thank you.
Lydia Millett, thanks again for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Next week, Ariana Newman talks with us about her book, When Time Stopped, a memoir of my father's war and what remains. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.